Welcome to the latest in corporate restructuring and insolvency. My name's James Harrison. I'm a senior associate at Penningtons Manches Cooper, specialising in corporate and insolvency disputes. And I'm joined by Amy Gallimore.
Hi, I'm Amy Gallimore. I'm a legal director and licensed insolvency practitioner in the restructuring and insolvency team at Ashford's LLP.
Turning to the agenda, we're going to be talking primarily about the Corporate Insolvency and Governance Act 2020, which I'll refer to as SIGA. Now, you're probably all aware of SIGA. It came into force on the 26th of June 2020, and it was intended to relieve the burden on businesses during the COVID-19 outbreak. But together with some significant temporary restrictions, it includes some of the most significant changes to UK insolvency law in a generation. It had a rapid passage through the UK parliamentary process, making its way from first publication on the 20th of May to royal assent on the 25th of June. And that pace has been seen in the lack of accompanying guidance, something that the Insolvency Service are working on, and the fact that the Act itself contains lots of Henry VIII clauses, which effectively are clauses that allow the operation of the Act and the legislation to be amended as it continues. And this is clear from the Insolvency Service's briefings that they fully expect the Act to be amended and to adapt to the circumstances. So what we're going to do today is we're going to talk first and foremost about the permanent changes. Amy's going to talk us through the restructuring plan and the moratorium. I'm then going to talk about the ipso facto clauses, otherwise known as termination clauses, before taking us on to the temporary restrictions, that being the restrictions on statutory demands and winding up petitions, before having a look at wrongful trading and a little bit of an update on directors' duties. I'm then going to hand back to Amy, who's going to talk about the Finance Act, before we have a look ahead at what might be in the future and do a bit of crystal ball gazing. But for now, I'm going to hand over to Amy.
Thanks, James. So first of all, we're going to look at the new restructuring plan brought in by SIGA. So schemes of arrangement are already provided for in Part 6 of the Companies Act 2006. SIGA has now introduced a new restructuring plan under a new Part 26A of the Companies Act. So that inserts new sections 901A to 901L in that Act. So just looking at the similarities with schemes of arrangement, restructuring plans are also a debtor in possession process. That means that management will remain in control and there isn't an insolvency practitioner appointed to administer, supervise or monitor as with other processes. Although inevitably specialist restructuring advisors will be closely involved in the plan's preparation and implementation. Also like schemes, plans are subject to court oversight and sanction. So there's the normal course of convening hearings and sanction hearings in terms of the court process. Again, like schemes, plans divide affected members and or creditors into appropriate classes, depending on how their voting rights, their rights are going to be affected. And each class will vote on the plan. Voting thresholds are 75% by value in each class. Schemes also have an additional requirement of 75% in number, which is not a requirement that applies to the plan. So that's a difference there. If sanctioned, plans will bind all stakeholders that are covered by the plan, which can include secured creditors. So that's a difference with company voluntary arrangements, but again, similar to schemes.
Amy, this seems to be quite a kind of a cultural change, and it seems similar to the Chapter 11 procedures in the US. What does debtor in possession actually mean for us in the UK?
Well, schemes of arrangement have been around in the UK for a long time and have been quite successful and popular with overseas companies restructuring, which I think is why the restructuring plan is largely modelled on the same framework. But restructuring plans are designed to fit more for distressed businesses, particularly where there isn't complete consensus. But as you say, the debtor in possession element, although it's been present in schemes, hasn't really been around so much in the insolvency or distressed restructuring space in the UK. So it's a sea change in terms of management continuing to run the business with a view to coming out of the other side and more of a rescue culture that they've managed to instill in the US under Chapter 11. So that does seek to align us with those over the other side of the pond. And in the US, that's been particularly well used and is well regarded. So moving on to the next slide to talk about eligibility. For a company to be eligible for a restructuring plan, there is no insolvency test as such, but there must be a degree of existing or forecast financial distress. So the company must have encountered or be likely to encounter financial difficulties that affect or threaten to affect its ability to carry on business as a going concern. Secondly, the purpose of the plan must be to eliminate, reduce, prevent, or mitigate those financial difficulties. So thankfully, we have an example here. We've got Virgin Atlantic Airways, which was first off the blocks, having had its restructuring plan sanctioned on the 2nd of September. That was the first restructuring plan to come before the court. And in that case, the airline had acute financial difficulties as a result of COVID. It was projected to run out of cash by the 5th of October and to default under finance agreements, which may have triggered enforcement action over the company's landing and departure slots at Heathrow Airport in around mid-September. So here, a restructuring plan was put forward to reduce the company's debt to a sustainable level, to provide for a deferred repayment schedule for that debt, and for there to be an injection of new money totaling around £370 million so that the company could continue trading in this period. So all four classes of creditors in that case voted in favour of the plan, and there were no challenges through the court process. And those four classes were lenders under a $280 million secured revolving credit facility, lessors of 24 leases of aircraft, creditors with IP licensing agreement and joint venture agreements, and certain of the trade creditors owed about £50 million between them.
But is the restructuring plan really designed only for FTSE 100 companies, though?
Probably, yes. In theory, any company which could be wound up under the Insolvency Act, including a foreign company, could be subject to a restructuring plan. That does at the moment include financial services companies, although under SEGA, their Secretary of State has got the discretion to disapply those provisions in that sector later. But you're right. I mean, in reality, the complexity and expense of preparing any plan will mean that it's going to be most useful to those with complex debt restructuring and or cross-border restructurings. Schemes are already pretty well established in those fields, which means that restructuring plans should be fairly competitively positioned, but in reality, it's going to be the large corporates that are going to avail themselves of these new provisions. So turning to slide 8. One of the drawbacks of schemes of arrangement is the ability for certain creditors to hold out and veto or disrupt a proposal that would otherwise save a company or otherwise achieve the scheme's aim, potentially for their own commercial reasons or to try and do a deal. To prevent that sort of horse trading, the restructuring plan imports a key feature of the US Chapter 11 bankruptcies, which is a cross-class cram down. And that means that if one or more classes don't approve the plan, the court could sanction it anyway. That is to say, if it considers it's fair and equitable, and that's a test that isn't defined in SEGA, but will no doubt adopt some of the case law developed for schemes of arrangement. And the court must also be satisfied that none of the members of the dissenting class would be any worse off than if the plan were not sanctioned, compared with what would be likely to happen to the company otherwise. And also that the plan has been approved by at least one class that would have the genuine economic interest if the plan were not sanctioned. So the cross-class cram down would enable debt for equity swaps to be imposed without shareholder consent, which schemes can't achieve, and it has the potential for empowering junior creditors.
But Amy, how does the court assess whether the dissenting class would have been better or worse off than under a restructuring plan?
Well, both those criteria that I've touched upon require consideration of the most likely realistic alternative to understand where the value will break. So the views of creditors who will either be paid in full or those who are unlikely to be paid in at all under either scenario won't be relevant. So you're looking at those stakeholders that have got some economic skin in the game. Identifying the most appropriate comparator can lead to argument through the court, and that may or may not be an insolvency procedure that is the relevant comparator. So for Virgin Atlantic, the cross-class cram-down wasn't engaged because all of the creditor classes approved it, but nevertheless, within the documentation, you have to look at the relevant comparison, and the realistic alternative in that case was identified as administration. So had that company been placed into administration, creditors would have been predicted to get between 10 and about 20p in the pounds with a dividend in about 2 years' time. And in contrast, the restructuring plan would have and will provide a much better return for creditors, up to about 80 pence in the pound for the trade plan creditors. Looking now at the moratorium introduced by SEGA, the concept of a statutory breathing space is familiar to several European jurisdictions and has long been discussed in the UK. And it's now been brought in by SEGA, which introduces a new Part A1 at the beginning of the Insolvency Act 1986. So the moratorium procedure itself is a standalone process. It doesn't need to follow from or necessarily lead into another insolvency process. In fact, it might run alongside one, for example, the preparation of a CVA. As another debtor in possession process, directors retain control of companies while considering their restructuring options without the immediate pressure from creditors. So moratoriums are available to almost all companies except financial services companies. And it's interesting to note that the Insolvency Service estimated when drawing up these provisions that the use of moratoriums would be around the same level as administrations. That remains to be seen. There are some difficulties for practitioners, but that is what the Insolvency Service has in mind in terms of its popularity. Like administrations, moratoriums will mainly be entered into by simple court filings without a hearing, unless the company is a foreign company or there's a winding up petition outstanding. To access the moratorium, directors need to make a statement that the company is or is likely to become unable to pay its debts as they fall due. And there's a statement from the proposed monitor, so that's a new role for a licensed insolvency practitioner who the directors will appoint to oversee the moratorium. So the monitor will confirm at the outset that the moratorium is likely to result in the company being rescued as a going concern.
But how do the monitors form that view given the uncertainties as a result of COVID-19?
That's a very good point, James. SEGA introduced temporary provisions which relaxed the likely to be rescued test until the end of September, recognising that there's so much uncertainty due to COVID. The relaxation of that requirement has recently been extended until the end of this year for any moratoriums that are already underway. So monitors don't need to form that view in relation to those companies. But for new moratoriums, the test will apply. And it's quite a high threshold to be satisfied that there's a likelihood of rescue. So in practical terms, those in the industry don't expect an influx of moratorium appointments. Businesses will probably need to be encouraged to speak to advisors at an earlier stage when rescue is more of a realistic possibility. A key feature of the moratorium procedure is a moratorium on creditor action. Similar to administration, it prevents enforcement of security or legal action being taken against a company in respect of pre-moratorium debts without the leave of the court. So it gives effect to a payment holiday of those pre-appointment debts. Unlike administration, though, it can only be the court that permits the lifting of the moratorium for enforcement action. So it can't be consented to by the monitor. At the same time, the moratorium imposes obligations on the company to pay the ongoing costs of running the business and certain pre-moratorium debts, which are the monitor's remuneration and expenses, goods or services supplied during the moratorium, rent in respect to a period during the moratorium, even if it might have fallen due for payment beforehand, wages or salary arising under contract of employment, redundancy payments, and debts or other liabilities arising under financial services contracts. So in effect, if there are bank debts which fall due before the moratorium, those will continue to be payable during the moratorium. So there really does need to be some discussion with banks and lenders during that period to ensure that those liabilities could be met. Directors can't make payments other than those that I've just mentioned or grant security or dispose of assets without the monitor's consent.
So, Amy, what is the role of a monitor?
Well, the monitor role is designed as an independent role to oversee the moratorium. So, as I've mentioned, to ensure that payments are made for ongoing debts, but also to represent the interests of creditors, for example, not allowing the company's assets to be diminished and be a bit of a check and balance against that. Although their powers are limited, they are monitoring rather than having any kind of executive role. The key for them is also to keep under review whether rescue as a going concern continues to be likely. And if one of these things changes to any worrying degree, they have to take a view on whether the moratorium can be continued with. Moving on to the next slide to look at time periods of a moratorium and how it comes to an end, slide 11. The moratorium lasts for an initial period of 20 business days, which can be extended once without creditor consent for a further 20 business days, or with either creditor consent or by the directors making an application to court for up to 1 year in total. The moratorium will come to an end either at the expiry of the moratorium period or sooner if ended by the company or the monitor. So, as I've previously mentioned, the monitor must terminate the moratorium where the company, sorry if I could just do that bit again. The monitor must terminate the moratorium where the company has been rescued as a going concern. So it might have refinanced or say a large debt or rebate has come in which might have alleviated the company's temporary cash flow problems. Conversely, where the moratorium is no longer likely to result in the rescue of the company as a going concern, the monitor must terminate the moratorium too. The monitor must terminate the moratorium if they are unable to carry out their duties due to the directors failing to provide sufficient information. Or finally, where the company is unable to pay the debts that it's due to pay over the moratorium period. So the moratorium debts or those pre-moratorium debts which aren't subject to a payment holiday. And to the last point there, the company will terminate the moratorium if it goes into a formal restructuring insolvency procedure. So a scheme, a restructuring plan, administration, liquidation, or company voluntary arrangement. James, if I could hand over to you now to talk about the last permanent change to the R&I landscape under SIGA.
One of the aims of SIGA is to protect companies from aggressive creditor action. And a key tenet of that has been the ban on ipso facto clauses, or otherwise known as termination clauses. These are clauses which were triggered by insolvency events in often supply contracts and sought to protect a supplier, often by imposing draconian terms, whether that be the right to terminate, the right to demand default interest or accelerated payments, etc. Now, lots of people are familiar with this already because there was already a ban on such clauses for essential supplies. That was previously utilities and then more recently extended to kind of your access to the internet or communications. Those have always been deemed essential suppliers and therefore protected. But SIGA takes those protections and expands them further. So when do they trigger is the important thing. And it's if a company enters into an insolvency procedure, then the supply of goods and services to a company can no longer be terminated or doing any other thing. So what do we mean by an insolvency procedure? Well, it's the standard ones. It's the moratorium, the administrative receiver, etc., but not a scheme of arrangement. So triggered quite broadly, but also doing any other thing. What does that mean? Well, actually, it's not defined and it's extremely broad. We touched on it a second ago. It could be charging default interest. It could be accelerated payments. I mean, it could even be enforcing guarantees that you already had the right to. So we're talking about quite a severe and strict change in the landscape for suppliers. Now, a supplier can still terminate for non-insolvency grounds if the default occurs following commencement of the insolvency procedure. But, and this is critical to note, if the right to terminate was triggered prior to the insolvency procedure, but the supplier didn't exercise the right, then they can't terminate once the insolvency procedure is in place. Therefore, practically, I think suppliers need to keep a close eye on their customers, their financial position, and not delay in taking action if they do want to protect themselves. Now, it's not that you have to keep on supplying and that you'll never be paid. If you are required to continue to pay, then you are paid as an expense of the insolvency procedure. But note, this doesn't extend to pre-insolvency debts. It just relates to those services that are provided after the insolvency procedure. But that is an imposition. And the reality is that the only way to get out of this is either by consent with the office holder in place or by making a court action to a court application for hardship. Practically speaking, it's likely to be that you need to just, a supplier needs to just get up on the phone with the office holder and ask if they want to for supply to be continued. But it does introduce a whole nother load of burdens on suppliers.
Are there any exceptions, James, that we ought to be aware of?
Yes, there are. Thanks, Amy. There are temporary extensions, but they've recently been extended to the 30th of March 2021, so quite a way ahead. And that temporary exemption is in relation to small companies. And that's where small is defined as having a turnover of 10.2 million or less, or a balance sheet of 5.1 million pounds or less, or 50 employees. And it also it is in relation to financial services contracts. I'm going to move on now to talking about some of the temporary restrictions. One of the other significant changes that's having an incredible impact on the insolvency sector at the moment are the restrictions on statutory demands and winding up petitions. At a stroke, the key strategy of suppliers and debt collectors everywhere has been removed. For statutory demands, they will simply be void if served on a company during the relevant period, that being the 1st of March to the 31st of December 2020. And while that broad brush approach has been applied to statutory demands, they will simply be void. The situation is different with winding up petitions. Here, the protection is linked to the worsening financial effect of COVID-19. Practically, what this means is that it creates a further layer of procedure. Previously, you either just put in a statutory demand and then a petition on the basis of that, or a petition on itself, and you started that way. Now, with these restrictions, we've had to have a new insolvency practice direction. And that sets out the additional requirements, being that the petition requires a statement that COVID-19 has had a worsening financial effect. It also introduces this delay that petitions will remain in private until the court has determined at a preliminary hearing that this test has been passed. And it's only after this hearing that the petition can be advertised. So we're talking of quite a burden here on would-be petitioners.
So James, as a debtor company, can I just ignore demands to pay for the time being?
Well, in one sense, yes, you can ignore statutory demands as void. I don't think that has stopped anyone serving them and trying to put pressure on people as a result. But the reality is that the option at the moment to pursue a debt is a Part 7 claim, which can be a more expensive, more detailed procedure. You can't necessarily just ignore a demand, otherwise you might be facing a claim form coming your way. Now, let's look at winding out restrictions in a bit more detail in the next slide. So, we talked about how a creditor cannot present a winding up petition in respect of an unpaid statutory demand or an unsatisfied judgment unless COVID-19 has not had a financial effect on the company, or two, the grounds for presenting the winding up petition would have arisen even if COVID-19 had not had a financial effect on the company. And during the relevant period, a creditor may also not present a winding up petition in respect of a company that is insolvent, either on a cash flow or balance sheet basis, unless the creditor has reasonable grounds for believing, again, COVID-19 has not had a financial effect on the company, or the company would have been insolvent even if COVID-19 had not had a financial effect on the company. And we'll talk a bit more in a moment about what that means. But these restrictions, they apply retrospectively. And if the court finds that the tests aren't satisfied, it may make any such order as it thinks appropriate to restore the company to the position that it would have been, which presumably is going to be in costs. So beware jumping in and putting in a petition without complying with these requirements. And we've seen that even prior to C coming into force, that there have been instances where the courts have exercised their discretion to dismiss petitions in anticipation of SIGA coming into effect because of the worsening financial effects. But we're going to turn to our next slide now to look at what this means in practice. So the critical question, what does COVID-19 having a financial effect on a company mean? Now, this isn't defined, and so in some ways it might just be a simple analysis of the net deficiency, but really, a simple test of has the financial position worsened is not necessarily as nuanced as it needs to be. I mean, we can all think of those examples. What about the business that mothballs part of their empire, which improves finances in the short term, but they may still be unable to make certain debt payments? What's going to happen with them? The reality is this is a tricky question for the court, and it's always going to be dependent on the facts. But given the aim of SIGA to protect struggling businesses from aggressive creditor action and the comments that have been made by judges previously, I'm anticipating that it's likely to be a broad interpretation of a low threshold. And therefore, if you can show some form of net deficiency, that could well be enough. Now, what does that mean for void transactions? Now, Section 127 of the Insolvency Act was and is a trap for the unwary. Previously, after the petition was issued, most transactions involving company property or shares were void unless the company obtained a validation order from court. And it was often one of those slightly difficult moments when advising a director of all the steps that need to happen just at this critical time when they're trying to save their business. But given the additional procedural steps that these restrictions have brought in place, actually SIGA now shifts the point in time for that to be triggered to the date that the winding up order was made. So really, the question is whether it renders Section 127 as slightly toothless now, because if the winding up order has been made, then control has been passed to the official receiver, and what more can the director do? The million-dollar question in all of this is, how much longer will these restrictions be in place? Whether they're going to be extended further. Currently, we've got the 31st of December 2020 as a critical time. And given the uncertainties over the economy and COVID-19, given our urgent waiting for updates on whether the vaccine trials have been successful or not, this in reality is a central plank of the government's attempts to reduce the burden of companies on companies at this time. So long as government feels that support is required, I do think it's likely to be extended further.
So at the moment, James, I mean, subject to that extension, we've got a potential cliff edge of the 1st of January when creditors could petition again in the ordinary way without these additional restrictions. So if we're acting for creditors, should we get our papers ready to present when the courts are open again?
Oh, thanks, Amy. Yeah, I mean, the short answer is yes. It could be a busy Christmas period for insolvency practitioners. There is a large pent-up demand. There's a serious question here about how much more suppliers and landlords can take before action needs to be taken. And so whether this focus on giving greater powers to debtors is creating an imbalance, who knows? But the reality is currently, if there is no extension, then yes, there is likely to be that large glut of statutory demands and petitions being presented. Now, let's move to our next slide to look at the wrongful trading provisions. So, wrongful trading, a quick reminder that a director can be found liable for wrongful trading where a company has gone into insolvent liquidation or administration, and the director at some point before the commencement of the insolvent liquidation or administration knew or ought to have concluded that there was no reasonable prospect that the company would avoid insolvent liquidation or administration, and the director cannot make out the statutory defence that they took every step they ought to have taken to minimise the potential loss to creditors. And if liable, then the court may make a compensation order for that director to pay up. Now, contrary to previous announcements made by the government, the effect that directors did not need to worry during this COVID pandemic, SEGA, despite what it says, does not suspend wrongful trading. Instead, the Act gives the court a direction to assume that a director is not responsible for any worsening of the financial position of the company or its creditors during the relevant period. Now, again, similar to winding up petitions, what does worsening of the financial position of the creditors or the company mean? Again, it's not defined. And I see this theme of a lot of power being put onto the courts to really try and work out how these tests are applied in practice. But we should note that different to the winding up petitions, this is not limited to COVID-19. So generally, is an increase in the net deficiency of the company during the relevant period going to be sufficient? And the answer is probably yes. Now, just to point out that this doesn't extend to directors of excluded entities, which is broadly speaking insurance and deposit taking banks.
So that sounds promising for directors in terms of having a bit of relief from their liability at the moment. Can directors act with impunity in this period?
I'm sure they would love to, but the reality is no. And I think that's actually one of those common misconceptions at the moment. Directors can still be liable for wrongful trading in this period. It's just that the quantum is potentially reduced. And as we'll consider later, SEGA does not switch off directors' duties. So, no, unfortunately, directors still need to be aware and still need to be complying with all their duties and managing their companies effectively. One of the notable factors about these restrictions is that they haven't been extended like those for the statutory demands and winding up petitions. We've had no real guidance as to why. It may be part of the Chancellor's winter economic plan to increase pressure on directors to take responsibility, or the recognition that the suspension provides only limited protection given the other potential claims against directors. We don't know why, but it hasn't been extended. So that period where they're not liable, where quantum is reduced, ended at the end of September. One of the suspicions is that there's the arguments about fraud right now, and whether that's the reason that this hasn't been extended, that pressure is wanting to be put back onto directors. But as we said, directors can still be liable for wrongful trading during the relevant period and beyond, just with potential quantum reduced. Therefore, it is still incumbent on directors to consider whether to file for an insolvency procedure now. And perhaps this explains in part the rise in popularity of CVAs, as directors seek to wrestle with debts and liabilities now, rather than when the temporary SEGA restrictions on statutory demands and winding up petitions are lifted. And another part of that, I suppose, is the fact that there have been no changes to fraudulent trading. And I'm sure you've been hearing the stories as much as I have of the fraudulent furlough claims. The last figure I saw was potentially 3.5 billion of them being fraudulent, and 26 billion of bounce back loans being fraudulent. I mean, this is an enormous scale. And there's the expectation in the insolvency sector that there is currently a lot of bad behaviour that will come to light subsequently and lead to litigation.
So, James, what should companies or directors in particular be doing at this time if they're worried about insolvency?
Well, of course, they need to be consulting their lawyers and getting clear advice. But really, the situation is the same as gone on before. Directors need to make informed decisions at these time. And how do you make informed decisions? It's with the benefit of information. So whether that's on your finances from your finance director or external accountants, from insolvency practitioners talking about potential restructuring options, or lawyers telling you about the risks involved, it's important that directors are fully informed, that they take advice and that they follow that advice and clearly record it, so that they can have a clear contemporaneous record to show to anyone in the future that they have taken all the steps that they reasonably could to protect the interests of the company and creditors. Now, we've looked at wrongful trading, so now let's look on to directors' duties at this time. So turning to slide 19, a quick update on directors' duties. And the obvious point here is that statutory duties of directors still apply. They still need to be complied with, and directors can still be sued for breaching them, making a secret profit, or etc., all those law school classics. SEGA does not suspend or change the offences related to misfeasance or breach of directors' duties, which is why many insolvency lawyers and practitioners thought that the temporary restrictions on wrongful trading were really toothless. Generally, if you're liable for wrongful trading, a director is also liable for misfeasance.
James, do you think that directors will be more likely to admit liability for wrongful trading in this period, given the changes relating to the initial COVID period?
There is a suspicion that directors are going to be happier to admit to wrongful trading given the reduced quantum. Inevitably, I think it's only ever going to really apply in those clear-cut cases. Any director, when faced with the differing levels of quantum, could well be looking to turn to wrongful trading, which is an interesting change, because previously The experience in this sector is that wrongful trading claims can be quite expensive to bring, quite time consuming, but we may see that changing. Now, moving on to the idea of disqualification. Well, similar to directors' duty, SEGA does not impact on the risk for directors being disqualified. Bad behaviour, being unfit to act, will still bring the risk of disqualification and a compensation order. Therefore, the message to directors is there is no impunity here. You still need to be carefully reviewing what you're doing and ensuring that you comply with your duties. And a helpful case, just to help hopefully bring some directors into line for you, is that directors' duties do live on past insolvency. I put on the slide the recent case of Re-System Building. Here, the court held that entering into administration or voluntary liquidation did not result in the removal of a director from his office and therefore end his duties under section 172(3), that being to act in the interests of creditors of the company. Here, the sole director negotiated with the administrator to purchase a property owned by the company at a substantial undervalue. To indicate that, in 2009, it was bought for £185,000. It was purchased by the director out of the administration for £120,000 in 2014, but it had an estimated value at that date of £200,000. So fairly egregious here. And accordingly, ICC Judge Barber held that at all material times, the director acted entirely out of self-interest and totally failed to have regard for the interests of the creditors as a whole, and therefore held that the director held the property on trust for the creditors, albeit with a credit for the £120,000 previously paid. So a warning to directors, just when an office holder is appointed, that doesn't mean that you can swan off into the sunset.
I'll look now at the Finance Act 2020 and the reintroduction of Crown Preference. On the 1st of December 2020, HMRC is due to regain preferential status for some tax debts more than 17 years after the Enterprise Act 2002 was brought into force, which abolished Crown Preference. So to add a bit of context, the reintroduction was first proposed without any prior warning in the autumn 2018 budget, due for introduction in April 2020. How the world has changed since. Attempts to prorogue Parliament and the general election last year meant that it wasn't legislated for then, but it is now contained in the Finance Act 2020, which was enacted on the 22nd of July.
So, Amy, what's the thinking behind this? What's the reason to reintroduce the status?
Well, the rationale was that all too often distressed companies spend the tax they collect from other taxpayers on propping up its own ailing businesses. So, for example, VAT and PAYE deductions for employees they were using to bankroll their own business, leaving HMRC high and dry in the event of insolvency. So this new legislation doesn't fully reinstate the Crown Preference status as it was before. This change will be more nuanced. And what it's done by Section 98 of the Finance Act, it varies the categories of preferential debts set out in Section 386 of the Insolvency Act 1986. So HMRC, from the 1st of December 2020, will have secondary preferential creditor status. That's to say they are behind other preferential creditors, such as employees, for certain claims. And it's worth noting that the type of tax debt is important. So not all tax liabilities will have this enhanced priority. Move on to looking at what will be covered. This regained secondary preferential status will relate only to types of HMRC debt where the business should have simply passed on tax already paid by third parties, namely for VAT, employee PAYE, employee national insurance contributions and CIS deductions. And those are in uncapped amounts. HMRC will remain an ordinary unsecured creditor for other types of tax, including corporation tax and employer national insurance contributions.
So will HMRC status depend on when the tax became due or if there was pre-existing security?
Well, provided that the tax falls into the right category that is noted on the slide, it will apply regardless of when the tax liability arose or became due, and also irrespective of when any affected floating charge was created. So fixed charge security won't be affected. But for those lenders relying on the floating charge security, it's arguably quite unfair because they may have taken security some time ago, having assessed their risk and looked at the commercial position at that time, what floating charge assets they were taking security over. And the effect of these provisions will be for HMRC to leapfrog them with direct effect on their security, and they'll have little control over that. So the next slide looks at how the priority of payments is affected. To put this in context then, it's useful to remind ourselves what the order of priority is and how that's being affected by these new provisions. So by way of broad overview, fixed charge holders are paid from fixed charge realisations, such as real estate or intellectual property or shares. And if there is a floating charge in place, any floating charge realisations, for example, from stock, will go first to pay the costs and expenses of the insolvency process, will then go to pay preferential creditors. And there are several types of these, but by far the most common is employee claims for unpaid holiday pay and some of their unpaid wages in capped amounts. And now we have a secondary preferential class, which is HMRC in relation to the qualifying debts we talked about. After that, we've got a prescribed part. So by way of reminder, the Insolvency Act provides for a proportion of floating charge realisations to be ring-fenced and to be paid to the unsecured creditors. So prior to the 6th of April 2020, the maximum value of the prescribed part was £600,000, but that's now increased to £800,000 for newly created floating charges. And then only after all of those items listed above have been paid or set aside are floating charge holders allowed the balance of the floating charge realisations. And after that, finally, unsecured creditors are paid any surplus.
So, Amy, how might lenders be affected and how do you think they're going to respond to this?
Well, it's interesting that the combined effects of these changes, so that's the reintroduction of Crown Preference and the increase in the prescribed part this year, is together expected to significantly impact the value of floating charge realisations for lenders when borrowers go into an insolvency process. And that, of course, inevitably in any discussion at the moment, needs to be looked at in light of COVID as well. So there will have been accrued tax liabilities as a result of the VAT payment holiday. So those tax liabilities are possibly higher than ever. The withdrawal of COVID-linked government support schemes in the coming months and the ongoing pressure on many businesses as a result of the pandemic are going to squeeze cash flow. So there's going to be a pinch point there where you've got higher tax liabilities than normal and potentially a queue of companies that are teetering on insolvency and are struggling. So it's anticipated that there'll be fairly high numbers going into a formal insolvency procedure towards the end of this year or the start of 2021. So effect on lenders is they're going to be slipping down the list of priority from the 1st of December. They may therefore try to accelerate action against defaulting borrowers before that date, as HMRC won't have their preferential status before then. And it's inevitably going to affect the structure of new borrowing or refinancing. So lenders may wish to restrict lending or consider other options instead of relying on the floating charge. So that might be invoice discounting and factoring arrangements or personal guarantees from directors as an additional alternative form of security. And on that cheery note, James, what are your thoughts on the restructuring and insolvency landscape in the year ahead?
Thanks, Amy. Well, Turning to our next slide, I think you can say from the blankness of that slide quite what we can anticipate. But let's look into the crystal ball and see what we can try and predict. I mean, one of the obvious factors is that the current insolvency service statistics that came out last month show a low number of company and individual insolvencies even compared to the year before. Now, that's an effect of the current restrictions. But given the economic crisis that our country is in, come 1st of January, subject to any extension to the restrictions, there are a lot of companies that are anticipating either entering into some form of insolvency process or facing urgent and aggressive creditor action. One of those things as well that we're going to look ahead at is that idea of fraud. We've touched on it before, the 3.5 billion in respect of furlough, the 26 billion of bounce back. There is this general expectation that a lot of the money that the government has just poured out has gone straight into the pockets of some badly behaved directors. And so it is anticipated that there's going to be a wave of claims, maybe not immediately. I think kind of insolvency practitioners are going to have to get their noses into the company books and records to try and piece things together. But I do think there's going to be a lot of claims against directors. And I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on HMRC and other government agencies to do what they can to try and claw back some of these pots that have been paid out. There's also just going to be all of those the pressures that come at the end of this year. Amy, I don't know, did you want to add anything?
Well, you're right. I mean, we've got the next quarter day coming up on Christmas Day. And although there have been restrictions on landlords taking action against tenants, not only by way of presenting winding up petitions, but the various other recourse, CRA and other forfeiture and other options that are open to landlords, that's been restricted to date. Those liabilities are only going to be increasing, and there has to be some discussion between landlords and tenants, hasn't there? They've got to do something with this.
Yeah, and I think also, I mean, the retail and leisure sector have taken a pounding, and as we look forward, is the Christmas period going to be their rescue, or frankly, is it just going to line the pockets of internet retailers and the big supermarkets, rather than those smaller entities that so desperately need it? I think that's probably one of the explanations for the rise in the popularity of CVAs, just that desire to try and see if there is a way to negotiate, to try and share a bit of the pain around here.
And I think we've both seen a push, whether within the CVAs or general discussions between landlords and tenants, to link rents with turnover and to move to a more regular payment system of monthly, perhaps, rather than quarterly rental payments, to sort of align their interests a bit more and to flatten out those cash flow issues that some of those businesses are facing.
Yeah, I can only agree. Unless we forget the B word, the 1st of January is not only potentially the first time that creditors will be able to serve stamp demands and petitions, but it's also B Day, it's Brexit Day, and the end of the implementation period. And who knows if a deal will be put in place? Who knows what the legal landscape will be operating in at that time? I mean, there's still the pressure, the argument of trying to get cross-border cases and insolvencies in now, while at least we know the regime that we're operating in at the moment. I think really, as you'll have gathered from what we're saying, that the theme for the future is uncertainty, waiting to see what happens with this pandemic, how the government reacts to it, and how the government deals with Brexit. But really, in these times of uncertainty, the insolvency sector comes into its own. SEGA has expanded the toolbox that we can operate with and given us more tools to try and restructure and rescue companies. So the message is there that for those companies that are in distress, there are the tools and the professionals that can help steer them through these times.
Yes, I agree with that. So we'll need to see what the take up is of these new measures, and how the government, by introducing the restructuring plan, the moratorium, is trying to promote that sense of rescue culture, whilst, unfortunate timing wise, we've got the reintroduction of Crown preference, which is only going to compound some of the problems for lenders and other stakeholders. But the government's attempting to tread the line between respecting the rights of creditors on the one hand to enforce and collect debts, and attempting to protect viable businesses on the other. So I think at that point, that's been a whistle-stop tour of the most recent developments, and we will keep an eye on those ahead in the coming year. Thank you very much for listening.